Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. All of a sudden it fills up. Okay. Where is your past? Could someone show me their past? I can wait all night. Where is your past? Where is it? It doesn't exist? Does the past not exist? The past is there. Our past is there. We don't have a tangible past. Remembering the past is useful, though. Remembering our experiences, because it's a way of, how should I put it, learning to have intelligent regret. There's a practice in ancient Tibet called Tundruk, and it was by the Kadampa masters that were known as the virtuous ones. This is around about 12th, 13th century in Tibet. And these masters would put a pocket full of black stones and a pocket full of white stones. And at certain times during the day, they would, firstly they'd start off during the day and they'd say, okay, today I am not going to tell a lie, or even a subtle lie, or even an exaggeration, and I'm going to be mindful. So that's my mindfulness practice for the day. And they'd have a pocket full of black stones, a pocket full of white stones. And say at about 9 o'clock or so, they'd go, right, I'll just do an inventory of what happened. Yes, I spoke to that person. Yeah, I really did exaggerate that. All right, black stone, top pocket. And then a few hours later, they'd check again. They go, no, actually, completely clear. They'd take a white stone. So what were they? They were developing the realization of what their mind was doing. And the more they did that, the more white stones they got. Because their intention was to improve their actions, their virtuous actions, and not to accumulate negative actions. And it's all right to say, oh, look, I won't do that today, but then, you know, habits come in. But when you're really checking, and in fact you can actually do this with a little notebook if there's something that you want to work with, and you can work through various different virtues, lying, gossiping, all these different things, covetousness, malice thoughts, negative thinking about other people, all those things can be included in this, a little list of the black and the white stones, in a sense. So the past is useful for that, but it actually only exists in your mind. There is no tangible past. Okay, what about the future? Where is the future? Anyone want to show me the future? Not possible either. It doesn't exist. We always talk about the future, but when we get there, it's the present. We actually never get to the future. It's like we have this ever-movable present going through time and space, but it's always now. In fact, you've never experienced anything except now. Nothing. And it depends how this talk will go. We may even get into the emptiness of that too. But that's another story. We'll see how we go with that one. If we've got time, we might talk about that, the emptiness of time. So, if we're living in the future, we're living in hope, aren't we? And that hope is always like a positive projection. You never hope there's going to be a disaster in the future, do you? We never think that. But one great master said, get rid of hope and fear. It keeps you agitated. Real enjoyment is actually here. Real happiness is right here. It's not in the future. What you are experiencing now is a result of what? previous karma. Everything you're experiencing right now is a result of previous karma. Everything you do now and think now will create the future. But if you spend your time wishing about winning the lottery and wishing about this and that and this, you're actually wasting your time and your energy. So the projection of the future is actually can be worse than that. It can have a lot of fear associated with it. Oh, I'm worried about this. I'm worried about my exam. Who's ever got worried about their exams? Oh, a couple. Yeah, come on, be honest. Everyone's worries about their exams. And you get more worried if you haven't done any study, haven't you? If you haven't done the assignments. That's great anxiety, isn't it? But the action to take care of that is preparation in the present, isn't it? If you don't prepare in the present and you hope that you will pass the exams, you may pass, but it'll be a bit dodgy, won't it? So if we start to realise that the power that we actually have is only now. And if we let go the fear of the future and the projection of the future, and someone will say to me, well, what about business planning? Okay, good idea. When do you do business planning? Right now. And if anyone knows about business planning, it's a changeable plan as circumstances arise. You never lock a 10-year plan in and expect to arrive in 10 years having completed it, particularly. Might be a construction job, but even then it will change. And if you look at the way governments work, they completely change their opinion every 3 or 4 weeks. We're going to do this. Oh, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this, and then we're going to do that. So they have very loose plans, and yet they try to convince us that they're in control. So in the end, if we let go this idea of hope and fear and really start to focus on now, it becomes a different experience. And I had a wonderful experience a couple of years ago. I was in Bali teaching Tai Chi. It was a wonderful thing to do, because what I was doing was I was donating a week of Tai Chi to help build a Buddhist monastery as a fundraiser, which was even better than if I had been paid, because I felt total freedom. I didn't have to ask anyone for money. I didn't have to go and make sure that the program was successful because I paid for the flight. I didn't have to think about any of that. And I was just able to teach Tai Chi freely for as long as I liked. It was great. And meditation. But in the evening, we went to see a performance of Balinese dancers. Beautiful, beautiful dancing. And what I saw, which really, really made me laugh actually, is all these people standing up with their phones, recording it. And they're doing this. I'm looking at the performance and they're making sure they get it. And I could just see what was going to happen. They were going to get home and they were going to say to their friends, look at this amazing performance of dancers. And the friends will go, yeah, oh yeah, it's great. No atmosphere, tiny little screen. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. They're living in the future of their friends going, oh, that's amazing, you're fabulous. That's fantastic that you could do that. When in fact, the performance was right there. And I'm not against taking photos and things, but this was half the performance. Making sure they got the right performance instead of actually experiencing the whole thing and the atmosphere. And that to me was a projection of the future, of the way, okay, I won't actually experience it now, I'll look at it later on a very small screen. And once you start to see things like that, you realise that we miss out a lot of experience by that projection, by that future capture. It's like looking at a rainbow. If we look at a rainbow and we see a beautiful rainbow, but we're desperate to take a photograph of it and we can't find our phone or our camera, then the rainbow becomes a problem. Instead of the enjoyment of it, of being present to the beautiful rainbow, and let's face it, a rainbow is impermanent. Probably some of the best photos I've ever taken on holidays have not been set up. They've just been a spontaneous thing. They're going, oh, bang. And they go, wow, that's not a bad photo. But it's not about living your life through a camera lens to capture all the experiences so you can think about them later. Because in the sense, they're actually just a memory. How many of you look at your photos of 6 years ago regularly? No? What, you don't go home every night and look at 2011 photos? But you took them. Do you see what I mean? We can accumulate more and more experiences on files and discs and whatever. But in the end, what we really need is to be right here now. An individual should be aware of their present moment instead of losing themselves in worry and anxiety about the past and the future. So past guilt. Oh, I did some terrible things. If we all look back into our past, we can remember times when we were really embarrassed. We really blew it and we go, oh, wow, how did I let that happen? But you actually can't do anything about that. This is why I talked about intelligent regret, just recognising that occasionally we've been unskillful and not to repeat it. That's it. Not beating yourselves up for things that you can't change. But what we can change is a decision not to do that action again. And the more we're mindful and present, the clearer we are about refining that. It's like polishing something. We're polishing our minds, our virtuous minds. So we have to see where the blemishes are, where the irregulars are, regular, so we're polishing gold. We have to see where the pits are so we can get rid of them. But it's not a beat up. It's not constantly feeling bad about ourselves. Feeling bad about ourselves actually isn't useful. In fact, one Buddhist monk said to me, he said, feeling guilt is like getting into a car and not starting the engine. Oh, I feel terrible, I feel terrible. And not going anywhere. So it's important not to focus on those feelings of the past. And as I said, the hope of, oh, it's going to be better. I hope it'll be better. It may not be better. This might be the best you get. Who knows? Wouldn't it be terrible if in 10 years' time you said, you know, the best time I had, you won't say this, by the way, was at Rod Lee's lecture on that Friday night. I was the happiest I ever was then, and I missed it because I was thinking about tomorrow. Tomorrow's picnic or tomorrow's, you know. Do you see what I mean? I promise you, you won't think that. That will not come up. But if you really recognise the incredible reason for being here now, and there was a famous, who's actually a famous professor, I think of Harvard University, named Richard Alpert, and he went to India. And he came across a very famous guru who completely changed his life, and he called himself Ram Dass. And he wrote a book in the 70s, early 70s, called Be Here Now. Still around in print. He didn't say be here tomorrow or be here yesterday. He said be here now. One of the wonderful quotes that a teacher once said, which I thought was just fantastic. I really love this quote. The difference between us and Buddhas are the Buddhas aren't distracted. That's it. The infinite now is actually infinite. The past is finite. and the future is finite, but the present is actually infinite. I want you to think. In fact, during this talk, I'm actually going to go through quotes of famous people on being the power of now, and also on mindfulness. And we're actually going to go through them and contemplate them. So it's going to be a little bit different tonight than just me talking all the time. I want you to really think about this. And the more we become focused and realise the power of that. Has anyone read Eckhart Tolle's book? The Power of Now? Yeah, a bit of it, yeah. He was very clever. He actually sat down and said what everyone was thinking. But Buddhism has been talking about this for many, 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 many thousands of years, 2,500 years. And any thinking person will come to the realisation that this is all we've got. And if you think about it, imagine that you have 24 hours to live, just 24 hours. But you've got to sleep, so there's 7 or 8 hours out of the 24. And then out of that, well, you've got to wash the dishes and cook the dinner and shop. And then out of that, you've got to, I don't know, wash your clothes, I suppose, study, go to lectures. And in the end, we don't have a lot of usable time to focus even on our meditation, our Dharma practice. So we don't have a lot of time to waste sitting and daydreaming about, oh, it's going to get better tomorrow. It's just got to get better tomorrow. And so the more we focus on it, and the great thinkers of the world have come back to this idea that this is where your power is. At each interface of karma, each experience we're having right now is a result of a previous cause, and we're experiencing the conditions. At this very moment is the point that we can change our future, change our experience of the future. But it comes from being very, very focused on the present, knowing how to act. Being mindful stops us walking into difficult karmic projections of the future that we have to experience. And it's very hard, quite often, this is the hardest point about dissatisfaction and suffering, is the acceptance of it. The actual acceptance of when it happens. We don't naturally, all beings, all want happiness. They never, ever, ever want suffering. And we do everything we can to have happiness and not have suffering. But it's important to note that some of the things that we think are going to cause us happiness actually are going to cause us suffering. I saw a program the other day, and I was actually just flicking through. I was at home, and it was a program, I can't even remember the name of it, but it was a guy who was losing money from his restaurant. He couldn't work out what was happening. And I saw someone that if they had have had one little grain of Dharma in their lives, their life would have changed. So they had these hidden cameras, and they had plants going into this thing because this guy wanted to know why his money was not adding up. And he also, it was America, and he had a table for Thanksgiving, and patrons would come in and they'd sit down and they'd also bring maybe some cans of food or something to put on the table. And this guy who is a plant comes in, he sits down with a big bag, and the waitress comes over, and she had with her, what she didn't know was, an apprentice who was also a plant of the organisation to just check on what was going on. And he said, oh look, I've got these things for the homeless people. And she looked in the bag, and there was an expensive bottle of wine, and there was lots of really good stuff. And she went, oh yeah. So she goes over, and there's the big table, and she says to the girl who's teaching the apprentice, who was the plant, oh look, we'll just take this into the back room. So she doesn't put it on the table for the homeless. She goes into the back room, she opens it up, she goes, oh look at this, look at this. And the first thing she says to this girl is, oh, I can take these home. And the girl says, but they're for the homeless. She says, oh, homeless people won't like that stuff. They don't need that kind of food. They don't eat good stuff like that. They don't need it. Meanwhile, the boss is watching this on a camera, And he's just horrified that this girl is actually even making this statement. Out of the generosity of his own heart, he's making people and then going to give all this food away. And the apprentice goes, do you think that's a good idea? Oh, yeah, look, it's a great idea. There's no problem about that. So there was a complete immoral judgment. Not only was she stealing, oh, that's right, and she went to the cashier and she said, oh, look, that guy's been really generous. Let's give him 10% off his bill, which wasn't her choice. And the cashier went, oh, okay, thinking this guy given a lot to the homeless. So anyway, the upshot of it was the girl got fired. And she was mortified that she was fired. She said, oh, it won't happen again. And she said, and get this, she said to the boss, well, they didn't need that kind of food. They don't eat that kind of food, homeless people. And there was a complete grasping at an opportunity. In fact, what she saved disaster, I've heard this line, saved disaster in the face of success. Instead of doing the right moral action, she created a lot of suffering for herself, not even now, in future as well, by that immoral behaviour. And so we don't have to go down that road. We're not that gross in our attitudes. But I recognise that just even in my life, through doing the Buddha Dharma, one becomes more accurate in their ability to deal with others. I once walked back two blocks to give someone back 20 cents at a post office. And the guy went, you're kidding. And I went, I don't want the problem. I really don't want the problem. For a start, the Dharma has taught me that karma expands. I may very well have kept 20 cents, but it might have expanded into a lot more. And the other day I had a great experience, and this was really Dharma thinking, and I'm certainly not the holy person, far from it, but I was walking up the street in Bellevue Hill and there was a $5 note sitting on the pathway, and I did an automatic reaction that I used to do when I was a kid. If I found 5 cents, I'd pick it up and I'd put it in my pocket, and I just stopped. I went, that's not my money. And I thought, and it was windy day, I thought, if I put it back on the sidewalk, it's going to blow away. And I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll hand it on to the next person. So I found there was a wall there, and I actually slid it so the $5 note was sitting out. And I walked away with such a nice feeling of giving that $5 away. Well, it wasn't mine anyway, but I was giving it away instead of putting it in my pocket and walking around with this heavy $5 note thinking, it was never mine. Someone lost it, and now someone else will find it. I was really hoping, I drove that way a few days later, that people kept putting it back in there and passing it on, but it didn't happen. Someone had gone, whoa, $5. But that's okay. I didn't want the problem. And so it's really interesting, the things that change our minds into the path of enlightenment and arhatship are the small things, the really little small things. When we take care of the small actions, the larger ones become a lot easier. We start to be aware of it, and that's really the way we transform. If we wait for something big to happen, oh look, when I get a lot of money, then I'm going to give to charity. Now, when I'm really rich, then I'll be able to give lots of money away, but I'll just get rich first. And no, I'm not going to give that person a dollar. I'll wait till I'm really rich. And if we do that, we're putting stuff off. And again, it's like a projection of the future. Or I'm going to really meditate when I have time. When I really have time, then I'm going to meditate. And then I'm going to practice. Or when I get the right cushion. Now, if I get the right meditation cushion, I know I'll be able to meditate better. So I'll just wait until I get the right cushion. And these things are projections of not being aware of the present. I love Pema Chodron's book, Start Where You Are. It doesn't say start tomorrow. It says start where you are. Has anyone read that book, Pema Chodron's book? Start Where You Are? Great book. and David Mickey's book, Hurry Up and Meditate. This is a kind of funny contradiction. There was never a time when your life was not now. There was never a time when your life was not now. You have no you in the past, and you will never get to the you of the future. So there was never a time when your life was not now, nor ever will be. This is it. This is it. And so if you're not experiencing some joy in the journey and you're waiting for the destination, you're going to be very disappointed. It's called death. So you've got to learn to enjoy the journey. When I first got into Buddhism many years ago, when I was about your age or younger, I first thought Buddhism was really stern and kind of lots of rules. And I thought, oh, there's no way. I want freedom. I don't want rules. Rules are really difficult. And I heard about monks having lots of vows and nuns having lots of vows. And I kept thinking, I don't want all those rules. Hello. Hi. And years later, I remember talking to a Western guy who had just become a monk, a friend of mine. And I said, what's it like with all the rules? He said, it makes me feel so free. I don't have to worry about things. And I really got that. When you have taken a vow not to lie, then you don't have to worry about the grey bits. You don't have to worry about the part where you go, oh, should I lie or shouldn't I lie? No, I've just actually made a vow, I'm not going to lie. It's difficult sometimes. Sometimes you have to feel embarrassed. Big deal. Just ego grasping. And more I find myself being very aware of just saying to people, look, I'm really sorry, I actually got that incorrect, or I didn't do that. I should have done that, or I wasn't mindful enough for that. And that's actually quite liberating. Quite liberating. Because when you try to protect the ego, what are you doing? You're kind of hanging on to something that actually doesn't exist, and you're trying to keep it contained so you're not embarrassed. Someone came to me a while ago and they said to me that they had bought an item in a shop. And they said 3 weeks before, they bought this item in a shop 3 weeks before, and the shopkeeper had given them another two of the one. She said, I only bought one, and the shopkeeper had given me two of them. And I said, so what did you do? She said, oh, well, that's the problem. She said, I don't know what to do. I said, well, why don't you go back to the shop and give it back? She said, oh, I'd be too embarrassed. And I went, really? She went, oh, yeah, it's been 3 weeks. I'd be really embarrassed to go back to... I said, well, why don't you go back to the shop and just give them the money for it? Oh, no, no, they'll know it was me and I'll be really embarrassed. And I said, so you're carrying a sack of guilt for a $5 object. I said, how long are you going to carry it? I said, you can very well go back to the shop and just take the embarrassment, big deal, and relieve yourself of this sack of guilt. I don't know if she ever did. She didn't look really happy with my answer. But it was obvious. And this is the point about acting now. When she got home, she realised that she had the object, but she waited 3 weeks of mental torture. And then when she came to me, she said, oh, I really wanted to ask you about this question. I don't know what she thought I was going to say. Oh, yeah, great. Can you share it with me? And that's the art of acting immediately. Doing things right on the spot because you're present to it. A I've given this question before, but some of you probably haven't heard it. You're walking along, you see a spider's web, and an ant has just got trapped in the spider's web. What do you do? Come on, give me some answers. Do you let the spider have the ant? Yes? You let the spider have the ant?
Yeah.
Okay, that's one answer. Right? This was a question put to us by a monk in 1978, my first Buddhist course. And I'm thinking, not sure about this. And there was good logic behind it when he explained it. So we've got let the ant have the spider. Well, that's the natural cause of offence of life, right? What else? So we could save the ant, couldn't we? Yeah? Who'd save the ant? Save the ant? Why would you save the ant?
Because at that moment there was something that you could do.
Perfect. What's your name? Yeah, right. What you just said is that you're part of the equation. And the logic from the monk was, well, let's face it, if you take the ant out of the spider's web, yes, the spider has just missed out on breakfast. Will it kill the spider? No. He's definitely going to, unless you stay there all day, which you're not going to do, because life isn't like that. So you become part of the occasion. Now, if the ant was completely wrapped in web, there's probably nothing you could do. In fact, taking it out of the web would pull its legs off and cause it more suffering. So there's not much you could do. But if it was just caught there and you could lift it out. But you're part of the equation. So karmically, you're there. The natural cause of things, yeah, okay, the spider's gone hungry and he's not going to be very happy with you. But you've saved the ant's life. These are some of the grey areas of being present. But you're present when that happens. And I do save ants out of spider webs if I'm there. And I come back a while later and the spider's still okay. Probably not happy with me, but he has, you know, he's probably got other food. Someone once said, oh, we'd just kill the spider. No, that's not right either. You can't do that. You know, it's not about getting rid of that to save that. So just looking at that, and that's again being mindful of what's going on right now. And if you use your wisdom, and I like the answer of that monk, I thought that was really, really quite valid. If you're very present to something, then you're open to it, then you have a better ability. The other option is you're walking along and you're thinking about your exams tomorrow and you don't even see the spider web and you tread on the spider web and kill the ant and kill the spider. Because you're thinking about tomorrow instead of walking along the path. All accidents in cars happen for three reasons. Either substance abuse, speed, or distraction. That's it. They're the only reasons. You may not have caused it, but the distraction of another driver may cause the accident. So that becomes a problem. As I said, we live in an ever now present time moving forward. But actually, there's no forward movement. It appears that we're moving forward, but actually not. We're actually just staying here. This is it. When you walk out the door, every step you take is here. It's here right now. You're not walking out the door in the future. You're walking out the door in the present. Everything you do is in the present. It also makes you recognise the view of multitasking. Multitasking doesn't work. Multitasking is phone on your shoulder, typing an essay, talking to your friend. That doesn't work. In fact, the psychologists say that it dumbs you down about 10% on each activity. But what you can do, which is really interesting, if you ever decide to do this little practice, it's very helpful. Be present for a couple of hours in a day. If you do it all day, you'll get exhausted. But just actually say, I'm going to be present to everything from 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. When I'm walking, I'm going to be aware of me walking. I'm going to be aware of the breeze on my skin. I'm going to be aware of everything around me for the next 2 hours. And do any activity you like. Might even be study or anything, but you're going to be totally present to what's going on. And the miraculous thing that happens, having done this myself, so this is from experience, is that all of a sudden you feel like you have a lot of time around you. It feels like things are actually a bit timeless. Because when you're worrying about or thinking about the future, you feel like you have no time. It's like you're trying to catch up to it. But you're not actually fixing the future, you're actually just thinking and worrying about it. So you can pull yourself back and be totally present. If you have to walk somewhere, then that's the only activity that you're going to do really there and then. I work with a lot of business people trying to bring them into the present before they get to work. And here's one of the techniques, all right? So this is actual technique. Very simple. Who comes to work by car? I mean, comes to the university by car? No one? Okay. So who walks? Okay. Who comes by transport, public transport? Okay. Any other methods? Anyone fly? Anyone got their own helicopter? No? Okay. All right. So try this in the mornings. Every time you get to a stop light, where you have to cross a road or something, just take a deep breath in and out. And with that outward breath, bring your mind into the present. And miraculously, when you get to your destination, guess what you feel? You feel really relaxed and grounded. Because we spend a lot of time doing an activity like walking and then worrying about stuff. You know, they often say, you know, when you walk through life, don't forget to smell the roses. We really don't do that very much. And one of the things that's happening is that because we've got faster and faster communications, we're actually speeding up. We're getting more stressed. We're trying to cram more and more in. And it doesn't work for us. The mobile phone is a wonderful thing and a big problem. It causes us to be distracted all the time. A friend of mine who lives in a house above a park, she saw two girls and two guys, obviously from lunch, and she said they were sitting in the park and they were eating lunch all together, and she said it was the most beautiful spring day. She said they were really relaxed, and the moment they finished eating, they got on their phones. And so immediately, you're somewhere else. You're talking to someone somewhere else. And I'm not against communication, but she said, I felt really sad that they just didn't sit there with the half hour that they had and really experience the park. It would have actually created a great nurturing experience. And in fact, there's a movement in Japan now, and a friend of mine's actually brought it to Australia, where business people, this seems amazing, they go out and they stand in the bush, in the bushes. Have you heard of this? Yeah? It's got a name, and I can't remember. Shinjuku or something like that. I can't remember the right name. And she said, in Japan, they're getting people out of office blocks and getting them into nature for an hour, and just to stand and walk amongst nature and just to let go all the stuff. There's an old stress management comment that says, even when you're dead, your in tray will be full. In other words, you will never get rid of the pile of papers. And if you think you will, by working harder and faster, forget about it. I've known people in the banking industry that work 70 hours a week to their ill health. One of the most successful consultancy companies in the world, McKinsey's, I was talking to a guy who had left McKinsey's. He's working for the Westpac Bank. He's a financial advisor. And I said, why did you leave McKinsey's? They're the most prestigious company in the world. He said, yeah, they wanted me to work 70 hours a week. And he said, I don't want that lifestyle. That's not happiness for me. I said, you would have taken a big pay cut. He said, yeah, but he said, I also took a big health bonus. He said, I was just being pushed way too hard. You could manage the 70 hours a week if you were really well structured. He wasn't a meditator. He might have handled it better, but he didn't. And he went out on his own, and he was very successful anyway. He's a bright guy. So we have to look at some of those things. And again, if you want to develop space around you and be present, start to let go. And someone said, well, how do you do that? You just stop. When the, oh, what if, comes up in your mind, you go, actually, I'm not going to think about that. This is what meditation does. It gets you to be present, because every time a thought comes up, and that's particularly why we did that meditation at the beginning. Did anyone find that difficult? It's harder than breathing meditation, that one. Because you're sitting there in anticipation, waiting for a thought to come up. And then you go, oh, I'm waiting for a thought. No, that's a thought. Oh. And it's like the walls are closing in. But it's a great way of looking at how our minds just keep racing. And they're racing for no reason than we've actually set them in motion. Wherever we are, it's all our fault. That's the good news. It's all your fault. That's the good news. Because if it's someone else's fault, if someone else is pulling the strings, we're in deep trouble. This is the empowerment of the actions of our minds and actions of our bodies and our speech. We're doing it. We have the power to become a fully enlightened Buddha. We have the essence of our Buddha nature. We have that already. And so often we talk about becoming a Buddha, but actually what we're really doing is revealing a Buddha. We can't acquire something outside ourselves. It's like me saying, oh, I can become Coco. I can't. It's not possible. You can't go, oh, I'm going to become the Buddha. You can't do that. The Buddha is the Buddha. All Buddhas are individuals. Even though they have omniscient minds, each Buddha has its own mind stream, its own subtle consciousness. So therefore, to become enlightened, it's not acquiring something outside of ourselves, it's taking away all the delusions. Every time we take away a delusion or we work on a delusion, we are freeing ourselves from samsara. Every time we do a negative action, we've just bound ourselves back into samsara again. So all we need to do, and the whole essence of Buddhism, and I have said this before here, is find out what creates a good cause and do that. Find out what creates a good result and do that. Find out what creates a bad result and don't do that. That's the whole of Buddhism. And by following the actions that create a positive result, you're revealing your Buddhahood. And eventually, when you've finally chucked off the illusion of your self-grasping, then you're free. I love the story of the Buddha when he had just become enlightened and he came across the Indian sadhus that he'd been hanging out with for 7 years. And they came to him, and one of them said to you, said to the Buddha, "Are you a god?" And he said, "No, I'm not a god." He said, "Well, are you a human?" He said, "No, I'm awake." That's it, awake. And I thought that was just the most succinct answer. Just awake. And so while we continue to be distracted, we're not becoming awake. We often don't accept the present, hoping that tomorrow is always better. In the words of the great Lama Zopa, good karma followed by bad karma, followed by good karma, followed by bad karma, followed by good karma. That's the nature of life. And eventually you can extinguish your karma, and then you don't have any good or bad karma that's going to plague you. But in ordinary life, good and bad, good and bad. And just accepting the experience of negativity, because that's the result of previous karma, relieves a lot of the anxiety. As someone said, pain is inevitable, suffering is a choice. Things are going to go wrong. I'm sorry to give you the bad news. Your cars will rust out. It'll happen. Even Rolls Royces. You know, the most expensive car on the planet. How much is the most... I think there's cars now. I think it's the Bayron, Bugatti Bayron's about $2 million. I don't want to tell the Bayron Bugatti company that their car will rust out. Even at $2 million. Just happens. So when we are more present to situations and we don't stress over them or wish they're going to be different, doesn't mean that we don't take action, but it's that overload of emotional tension that we put on things that causes so much grief. And that tension actually brings more illness. If someone gives you bad news about an illness, you do everything you can to help it, fix it. But in the end, you still also have to patiently accept where you're at. They might say, look, it's going to take 3 months before that's cured. Well, what, are you going to fret for 3 months, or are you going to accept that situation? And the less you stress over things, the calmer and more peaceful your mind is, because it is only about mind. Just a thing here I've got here. Why don't we focus on the present? Actually, often it's due to our agitation. When the mind's really calm and peaceful, it's much easier to be present. But when we're anxious and agitated, then we'll often grasp towards this. And so this is why the practice of meditation is so important in Buddhism. It brings one into the present, because you're dealing in present time with thoughts and ideas that come up, and you're leaving them alone. You don't sort them out. You let them go. That's a training for daily life. Meditation is not a place, as you know. It's an action. And the action is the training of the mind to be present. That's it. The simplest practice of watching the breath is the practice of being present. And if we do that regularly, then just by sheer nature of doing that practice, or as my teacher used to say, don't think about it too much. Just trust in the practice. It's been going on for thousands of years. Just trust in the practice. Many, many people have become enlightened by doing this practice. Just trust in the practice. It's okay. You don't have to worry so much about it. Just do it. Just do it. You don't have to think and change it and do stuff. Just do it. They're all there. We're so lucky in the Buddhist faith that we have a teacher that was around for 50 odd years who gave us so many techniques. So many techniques to be present. Okay, so how are we going for time? Okay. These are some quotes. And I want you kind of, we'll talk about them and maybe contemplate them. The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, worry about the future, or anticipate troubles. That's a good one. If I worry about it, then I'll be prepared for when it comes along and then I can act accordingly. If you really think about it, how many times have you anticipated a fear? I'm not talking about planning now. And it never works out that way. Never. I'll worry about that now because then when I get to it, I'll be prepared. It doesn't work that way. If you're doing good planning, yeah, absolutely. When I was running the security for the Dalai Lama, we had running sheets that were 5 minutes apart. Something happened every 5 minutes. But that was planning, and we didn't worry about it. In fact, we didn't worry about it because we knew the planning was every 5 minutes. And so if something went off in 5 minutes, we had very short periods of time to correct it and the resources to do it. A good tip was given to me by a Lama when I said that I was doing the first security for the Dalai Lama. I had a team of 84 people. This was 1996. I said, "What's your advice? I thought it was going to be profound. It was profound, actually. He said, "Check three times." He said, "Not twice, three." Okay. Three times. And I did, and it solved a whole heap of problems. When I checked three times, it didn't mean I worried three times. I checked. Is that door locked? Is that door locked? Yep, that door's locked. I don't have to think about it now. So it actually freed my mind by acting now. Do you remember what the great Shantideva said in the 8th century? If it can be fixed, why worry? If it can't be fixed, why worry? That's a present time observance of things. Can I fix that? Yep. Can I not fix it? No. Okay, well, I'm not even going to think about it. It sounds unbelievably irresponsible, doesn't it? But that's actually how you can live your life much better. By knowing the things you can change, knowing the things you can't change, and accepting the things that you can't change. Live in the present moment wisely and earnestly. And that was by the Buddha, that quote. So I'll read the whole thing. The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, worry about the future, or anticipate troubles, but live in the present moment wisely and earnestly. And earnestly is a kind of an old-fashioned word, but it means just being focused. This is by Abraham Maslow. Does anyone know, heard of Maslow? He's an economist. And he said, the ability to be in the present moment is a major component of mental wellness. It's a great quote. The ability to be in the present moment. Isn't that interesting? The ability. We're in the present moment, but we don't have the ability to be in the present moment. I find that amazing. It's true. We're living there, future and past. So the ability to live in the present is a major component of mental wellness. And I'd add to that happiness too. Life is all memory, except for the one present moment that goes by you so quickly you hardly catch it going. That's by Tennessee Williams, the playwright. Life is all memory. There's a Zen saying that I came across many, many years ago, even before I got into Buddhism myself, and I was reading it when I was about 14, and I think it was by D.T. Suzuki. It was by D.T. Suzuki, and it's also reiterated by Zen teachers. Die to every moment. That sounds rather dramatic, doesn't it? Die to every moment. But what it means is let every moment go. If you're always there, thinking about what has, you're never experiencing what is. So life is all a memory, except for one present moment that goes by you so quickly you hardly catch it going. This is by John Kabat-Zinn. And John Kabat-Zinn, does anyone heard of him? Probably haven't. He was a professor in the 70s at the university. I don't know. Does anyone remember what university was at? Might have been Harvard, California University. And he stuck his head out in a limb and developed mindfulness-based meditation, which was actually the meditation we did first off today. And all the professors thought he was a complete loser and hopeless and a, you know, hippie and whatever. And he developed the most powerful meditation practices for ordinary people, not religious people, just the basic tenets. And so he said this one: this is the only moment any of us ever gets. You're only here now. You're only alive in this moment. You're not alive yesterday, and you're not alive tomorrow. You're only alive now. But when you get tomorrow, you'll be alive now. And when you get there the next day, you'll be alive now. And every moment is that. Okay, I'll keep going. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday. So that's karma. Our previous thoughts created us to be where we are now. Our present thoughts build our life tomorrow. Our life is a creation of our mind. And that was by the Buddha. Our life is a creation of our mind. I think that's fantastic. It's not a creation of our circumstances. It's not a creation of our wealth. It's a creation of our mind. And that's really the most wonderful thing, because we actually have this mind of awareness. And we can use it in so many ways. It can be destructive, it can be creative, it can be extraordinary. But ultimately, it also can become the mind of a Buddha, eventually. This is one by Sri Nisargadatta. This is a Hindu guru. And he said, past and future are only in the mind. I am now. I am now. That's an interesting way of putting it. I am now. I exist now. Any questions so far? You've all been very silent. I can see you're all awake, but you've been silent. Any questions? No? I guess it's reasonably self-evident. It is. Okay, I'll keep going. The meeting of two entities, the past and future, is precisely the present moment. The past exists because of the present, and the future exists because of the present. We can only remember a past because we've had a present. We can only anticipate a future because we have a present. But both the past and the future are gone. Not arisen and completely gone. Okay, I said I'd throw in emptiness. Here you go. Sorry about this. Which part of the present is the present? The P, the R, the S, the E, the N, or the T? Could someone point, I've asked you to point to the past, and we know that's a memory. I've worked out my projection of the future. Where exactly is the present? Is it half a nanosecond? Is it a millionth of a nanosecond? Is it a billionth of a nanosecond? How small can we get? Sorry, I'm rocking a few boats here. I'm doing it on purpose. Think about it. And where are you going? Time is empty of inherent nature. It has no substance. It's a concept. Causes and conditions. Past is dependent on the present. The future dependent on the present. Because it's empty doesn't mean that we're not experiencing it. But we see it as an entity. And the reason we can say it's empty is because we have different perceptions of time. When you're sitting listening to a boring lecture, I'm not one of them, time can really drag. It's like, oh, this guy's droning on and on and on. Or if we're excited about something, it can go like that. Which means if time had an inherent nature, it would be finite. The experiencer would be the same for everyone, and it's not that case. So although we talk about these relative terms, they're also empty of inherent existence, a dependent arising. But that doesn't mean that we can't talk about the present. It's a dependent arising we can talk about. This table is a dependent arising. It's empty of inherent existence, but it still exists. I can use it as a table. We have to be careful with that in emptiness. Often people say, well, if it's empty, it doesn't exist. No, it's just empty of inherent existence. It's a dependent reality. And that's fine. Everything is a dependent reality. Everything that we look at is a dependent reality. Our minds are dependent reality. One moment of consciousness is a result of a previous moment of consciousness. That's the way it goes. All right, I'm going to get... I just want, thought I'd throw that in. Yep?
Sorry, Rob, can you repeat the quote again?
The
past and future is meeting in the present or something?
Oh, dependent on? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the quote itself.
The quote from the quote.
Can you repeat that line again?
Oh, what I had here? Oh, sorry, yeah. Okay, yeah. The meeting of two entities, is that the one?
Yes.
The past and present is precisely the present moment. So the meeting of two entities, past and future, is precisely there. Okay? It's just reiterating what we were saying before. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, no, I thought it was something I said. But yeah, no, so it's the meeting of two entities, the past and the future. Okay? That's it. And that's it the whole time. When you start to realise that this is all you've got, it's kind of exciting. Because we don't have to worry so much about the future. We just have to be really focused on the present, and that's all we've got. So the more you focus on the worry and the fear of the future, the less effective you're going to be. Have you ever experienced, and you've all probably experienced it at some point, where you've been so worried about an exam you can't study? Has that ever happened to you? Like you're really freaked out and you're going, oh gosh, I haven't studied that. And what happens? How's your study? It's less effective, isn't it? Instead of going, okay, yes, I haven't done the work, but at least I'll pass some of it and be present, rather than, you know. And this is how we can, and honestly, I always believe in Buddhism being practical. I don't like it just as theory, I like it to actually be practical. A technique of becoming present, and this is interesting, because when we have a lot of anxiety, our respiration rate goes up. We need more oxygen. And the way they measure how relaxed you are is the least amount of oxygen that you need. So the more relaxed you are, you need less oxygen. So the breath being part of the fight or flight response, if you want to, and you realise you're becoming agitated, and that agitation is not beneficial, then change your breathing. And again, this is a technique. There was an Australian psychologist, I can't remember his name for the moment. It'll come back later. But he developed a book called The Third Space, which is very clever. He said between one activity and the next, there's a gap. So you're at a particular, and we'll use a business model here, you're at a business meeting here, it's been a really difficult meeting, there's been lots of conflict, there's lots of problems coming up in this meeting, and you've got to go to the next one. If you take the energy of that frustration and difficulty into the next meeting, you'll walk in and you won't be really focused. You'll be kind of agitated and you may get the wrong information. So between there and there is the third space. And you know what you can do in the third space as you're walking down the hallway to the next meeting? Take a really deep breath and exhale. And focus on that. And you let that go. And then when you walk in here, new place. Because if you're taking that with you, you're taking the past into the future or into the present, and it's clouding your judgment. It's with communication. If you're totally present to communication now, then you will get all the facts and all the information that you need from someone. And if you're really present to them, something magical happens. If you want to be listened to, and this is a definite fact, if you want to be listened to, you listen attentively to the person that's talking to you. And I did this with a course I was running for the ACCC. And I said to them, okay, I want you to be present to three conversations. Two colleagues and a family member. And I was doing it over a four-week period, but this was 1 week. And I said, when you come back next week, I'm going to ask you your experience. And this one woman, I think she was a solicitor that worked for the ACCC, came back and said, oh, I had the most amazing experience. I said, what was it? She said, I listened to my son. I said, what? She said, my 14-year-old son, I sat down with him on Sunday afternoon and I was totally present. I didn't run an agenda in my head. I didn't tell him what he was talking was rubbish, which I often do. She said I was completely open to his communication. And he told me stuff I couldn't believe. He opened up all this stuff that was happening in his life. I said, what do you normally do? She said, oh, be quiet, John. No, shh. And she said, I just sat there. I didn't run my story. I didn't run a criticism. I didn't run anything. I was just completely open and present to his conversation. Someone I did this for just a few weeks ago, same technique, working in a company, and they said, it was quite amazing. I'm talking to this manager and I'm being totally present. And she kind of sat back and started being really connected with me. And then when I spoke, she was really listening. You create a resonance. I've had that experience, fortunately, with the Dalai Lama, which is almost a little too powerful. When you're in front of the Dalai Lama and he asks you a question, he's 100% there. So much that it's almost, and he's not doing it to be intimidating, he's really listening to you. And it's an amazing experience. You actually feel like you and he are the only two people in the universe, because that's all there is. And it's actually, because his mind's so present, that's the kind of experience that you get. So I'm giving you all these examples. I do want to get through some of these too, because we'll get through some of them. But there's some of my experiences of being with people that are present, or in getting people to be present. So try this communication. Here's some homework for you. I never give homework, but you're getting homework now. I feel like a real professor. No, not really. So what I want you to do is to someone over the weekend, doesn't matter, not in this group, because they'll work it out, all right? So it has to be someone who isn't here. What I want you to do is, when you're having a conversation with them, I want you to be completely present to that conversation, but without running a commentary in your head. Okay? Oh, they're talking a lot of rubbish again. No, none of that. Or, oh yeah, I was thinking about the time that I... None of that. Be completely empty and open to their conversation. Completely. I think you'll notice something very unusual will happen. Two things happen. This is according to Zen Suzuki Roshi, and he said, if you want someone to see an error in their conversation, be totally present without following it, and they will realize the error of their own conversation. It's not a manipulation, it's just being open. And if someone is talking a lot of silly stuff, by just being open, you've given them all the ground for that to dissipate. And then they may get to the point where they're really, really talking sensibly. Again, it's not, you're not manipulating it, you're not judging whether it's rubbish or not, you're just being completely open to that conversation. Do it with a couple of people if you want to. I think you'll notice that it's really worthwhile, and it's a mind training as well. It's training your mind to be present by just using a conversation to do it. So the breathing technique, if you realise you're agitated, relax the body. It's a very interesting thing. You can't have an agitated mind in a relaxed body. You can't have an agitated body with a relaxed mind. You relax the body, the mind will follow. That's just natural. So that's why in meditation, when we sit, we don't say, right, now make your body really tense and agitated, now concentrate. What do we always say? We go, relax, just relax, follow the breath, relax on the outward breath, relax. And the more the mind relaxes, less agitation, more present time awareness, more effectiveness, more power, more clarity. What have we got? Okay. Tolstoy, famous Russian writer. Now is the only time when we have any power. True. The only time we have the power to do anything is right now. This was by... You remember I mentioned Ram Dass, the university, American University professor that changed his name to Ram Dass? This is his one. The message you need is always right here where you are. Which is pretty obvious, because the moment you get a message, you're right here, there, where you are. Even if someone left a message yesterday, when you get it, you're right here, now, where you are. It's kind of a bleedingly obvious comment, but it's a nice way of putting it. The message you need is always right here, where you are. This is by Thoreau, another writer. Fools stand on their island of opportunity and look to another land. There is no other life but this. That's the projection of, the grass looks a lot greener over there when you're standing on green grass. I'll read that again. Fools stand on their island of opportunity and look to another land. There is no other life, or no other time, we could say, but this. That was Thoreau. Okay, another one. Life is a series of spontaneous changes. We'd have to agree with that. Don't resist them. That only creates sorrow. Let reality be reality. Let things flow in whatever way they like. That was Lao Tzu, the great Taoist master. And interestingly enough, he was around at the time of the Buddha. So the time of the Buddha had a golden age of thinking. There was the Buddha. 12 years later, Mahavira was born. He was the head of the Jains. Very similar philosophy to the Buddha. Confucius, Lao Tzu, and Pythagoras, all at around 500 BC. They called it the golden age of spirituality and wisdom. And people in those days, they would just listen to the Buddha once and they have complete realizations of the path. Their karma to be born at the time. Well, you can imagine. The karma to be born at the time of a wheel-turning Buddha is unbelievable. We're lucky that we're in the period of his 5,000 years of teachings. I mean, that's amazing. If you think of the possibility of the countless, and we talk about that in Buddhism, countless universes. So according to some texts of Buddhism, in the Milky Way, which has 200 billion stars, we have 1,000 inhabited planets. Only 1,000. Okay. You multiply that by 300 billion galaxies that were observable, there's quite a few planets. Within those planets, and they have the three realms of existence. Imagine how many insects on each of those planets that have consciousness. How many of those planets don't have the Buddha Dharma? How many of those beings are not connected to it? And here we have a population of this world that have the opportunity to receive the teachings of how to become enlightened. Absolutely, as they say, as rare as stars in the daytime. And we have the opportunity of utilizing it in every action. And I don't mean sitting down and meditating 24 hours a day. If you had the luxury, fantastic. Good luck to you. But we don't have that luxury. But acting in accord with the virtuous mind as much as possible. As much as possible. If we have that ability to do that, then we are doing the practice. We're doing the path. This is one from Eckhart Tolle, who wrote The Power of Now. It is through gratitude for the present moment that the spiritual dimension of life opens up. The gratitude for the present moment. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. Rejoicing that we have consciousness right now. Right now we've got it. So that is certainly a moment for gratitude. Who's this one by? Oh, another one by Eckhart Tolle. When you take your attention into the present moment, a certain alertness arises. You become more conscious of what's around you, but also, strangely, a sense of presence that is both within and without. I'll read that again. When you take your attention into the present moment, a certain alertness arises. You become more conscious of what's around you, but also, strangely, a sense of presence that is both within and without. Even I would even hesitate tonight, even us talking about that, is getting a sense of being present. Are you noticing that just in the room? This kind of feeling of just becoming more centered here. I hope this is what we're experiencing, because it's really important. This is really the most important teaching. Big business hasn't picked up mindfulness for any other reason than it works for people. It makes them happier, it makes them more profitable, makes more money, the whole thing. It's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. Great that modern business is actually taking up a way of well-being that is beneficial for the workers. And they have companies now know that when people are working for them and they're happy and focused and clear and relaxed, everyone wins. The worker wins, the boss wins, the company wins. Stressing people out and making them fearful of the present or losing their jobs or worry, don't work. Huge attrition rates in companies that do that, and people lose their jobs and walk out. It doesn't work. Okay. This is by a woman called Mary McDonald. We have to get back to the beauty of just being alive in this present moment. Again, from Eckhart Tolle, the more you live in the present moment, the more the fear of death disappears. That's a tough one. We often have the fear of death, but the more you are here, you can't do anything about that future. All you can do about is now. It is better to travel well than to arrive. That's the Buddha. There was, and I've mentioned this before in these talks, there was a guy called Gary Schneider who was a poet in the 50s in America. And a lot of his contemporaries, people like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, who were poets and writers, used to talk about meditation and Zen. They were really getting into the Eastern kind of view of things because it wasn't really prevalent in America. And Gary Snyder got a bit sick of them all kind of talking about it, so he went off to Japan and studied Zen Buddhism. And over a 10-year period, he developed a very strong practice of meditation and was really, really good. He's still alive today, by the way. He's about 98. And they said to Gary Snyder, So you've been doing meditation for 10 years, and so what's your practice? He said, oh, when I'm walking down the street, I say to myself, what are you thinking now, mind? That's it. What are you thinking now, mind? And that's a present time activity. What are you thinking now? What is your mind doing right now? Perfect timing. And that's really a practice that you can do yourself. What am I thinking now? Am I thinking fearful, negative thoughts, grumpy thoughts, grasping thoughts, anxious thoughts, or is my mind clear and present? If it's not, make it clear and present. The way you make it clear and present is to let go of the stuff that's causing you anxiety in your mind, just as you do in meditation. If every thought of meditation, when you're sitting in meditation, every thought that went past you jumped into it, you're not meditating. So you let it go, and you learn to do that as your daily practice. Let it go, be present. Let it go, be present. Listen, be present. Talk, be present. Oh, the last one from me. Pay attention. Rod Lee quote. And now I'll give you some mindfulness quotes. So being present is the desire, and mindfulness is the technique for doing it. This is a guy called Walter Landor. As soon as we wish to be happier, we are no longer happy. That's a great quote. We're enjoying ourselves. Oh, I want more happiness, instead of actually enjoying it. This is a delicious dinner, but theirs might be nicer. Good way to get a fork in the back of your hand. and this is about our actions, all right? If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. There's an activity that you can practice right here and now, compassion. Everything that we do as an action is a present time action. We can't, look, I think I'll just be miserly and horrible now, and tomorrow I'll be compassionate. That's good training, isn't it? This is from Pema Chodron. If we learn to open our hearts, anyone, including the people who drive us crazy, can be our teacher. Did anyone hear the story of Atisha's cook? Okay, Atisha he was brought to Tibet in the 11th century, famed from Nalanda University, and he was asked by the king to really kind of re-stimulate Buddhism with a lot of the Indian text. And he was a famous teacher. So Atisha comes to Tibet, and after he was there for a little while, one of the Tibetan masters came to him and said, look, Atisha, you know, your teachings are amazing. You've really inspired us and given us better techniques and whatever, but we just want to talk to you about your cook. He's really horrible. He's nasty, he's grumpy, he's aggressive, and he can't cook. We have so many cooks that can do a wonderful job for you. Can we give you one of our cooks? And he went, oh no, here's my most precious possession. Yes, I know he's grumpy, I know he's awful and he can't cook, but without him I can't practice patience. He's fantastic. So they got the message. Mindfulness is simply being aware of what is happening right now without wishing it to be different. Enjoying the pleasant without holding on to it when it changes. Being with the unpleasant without fearing it. Always, it will always be this way, which it won't. So I'll read that again. Mindfulness is simply being aware of what is happening right now without wishing it to be different. Enjoying the pleasant without holding on to it when it changes, which it will. Being with the unpleasant without fearing it. Without fearing it will always be this way, which it won't. So things always change. That was James Barat's. Each morning we are born again. What we do today is what matters most, and that's the Buddha. And in fact, each moment we're born again, each moment is completely new. You have never, ever done this twice. Not possible. And what I mean is this. 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 No, this. You've never done it twice. Completely new. So when you're doing the most boring home chore, going, oh, I really don't like doing this, just remember you've never done it twice. Ever. That's the first time you've done that. That. And this is the first time we've had this. All of us. It's my first time with this. I can't make it smaller than this. Maybe or is. But that's it. That's all you got. Our own worst enemy cannot harm us as much as our unwise thoughts. No one can help us as much as our own compassionate thoughts. Again, getting back to the mind. That's by the Buddha. And this is from Kalu Rinpoche talking about our nature of mind. The mind in its natural state can be compared to the sky, covered by layers of cloud which hide its true nature. So this is when we're overthinking. When my teacher Geshe Loden got to the West, he said, "Ah, you people, always thinking, non-stop thinking. Just stop it. It makes confusion." Or at the beginning of his lectures, he used to say, "I am lonely person, I am bored person, my husband has left me, my wife has left me, my boyfriend has left me, my girlfriend has left me, I've lost my job, I don't have enough money. This is useless thinking. Throw out like bad socks." In other words, we can spend a whole heap of time thinking about stuff that's completely unimportant. The great Jack Kornfield. "We are awakened to the profound realization," this is all on mindfulness, "we are awakened to the profound realization that the true path to liberation is to let go of everything." That's scary, isn't it? Let go of everything. This doesn't mean that you'll just disappear. It means let go of our grasping, our attachment. Experience things fully. If you're drinking the most beautiful cup of tea, and you wish it was hotter, colder, tastier, you've just missed it. This is the only tea I've got. This is the first time I've tasted the tea. And this is the first time I've tasted the tea. And on it goes. And from the great Matthew Ricard, Buddhist monk, "Envy and jealousy stem from the fundamental inability to rejoice at someone else's happiness or success. Envy is this wish to have something that you don't have. Jealousy is being jealous of something someone else has. You don't have it because of your karma. The envy and the jealousy just causes you suffering. That's it. When you rejoice in someone else's happiness, you actually do some wonderful things." And I'll tell you a story of a gentleman that used to come to our centre called Bob. And we're talking about rejoicing. And he was sitting at this talk. And I said, "We can live our lives being really envious of people and what they have and we don't have it." And it was just a general talk I was talking about. And I said, "But the practice of Buddhism is to rejoice in someone else's good fortune." And that was pretty much it. He came back the next week and he went, "Oh, I've just had this most amazing experience." I said, "Yeah, what, Bob?" He said, "Well, I was the poorest person, our family was the poorest people in the street." He said, "Our house was definitely, our family was the poorest in our whole street." And he said, "Up the road were the Smiths." And he said, "The Smiths, we didn't like them, they were really rich." He said, "We really didn't like them. They had lots of money, and we used to talk about how much we really didn't like them because they had money. They went on holidays overseas. They had a pool in their backyard. We didn't go on holidays. We couldn't afford it. And we didn't have a pool, but we really disliked the Smiths." He said, "We never spoke to the Smiths or even talked to them. We never even said a word to them because why would you want to talk to people like that? They were horrible." This guy was 55 at the time, and he said, "And guess what I did during the week?" I said, "What did you do, Bob?" He said, "I drove back in front of the Smiths' house, and I sat there and rejoiced in their good fortune." He said, "They probably weren't living there anymore." He said, "I guarantee they weren't living there anymore." But he said, "That was the symbol of a lot of our negativity in our growing up. Oh, there they go again in the new car. We really don't like them." And you can see the whole thing. They built this whole story up, the family, Bob's family. And he said, "I just sat there for an hour and really rejoiced in their good fortune and their good karma." He said, "You know what? It was like this whole load was taken off my shoulders. I felt fantastic." He said, "I've let the Smiths go." And he said, "I didn't even know I was carrying them around. A load of negative Smiths." And he liberated them, and he was really happy. And he said it really made a difference to his mind. And he said, "I looked at that stuff." That's the value of going into the past. That's the value of it, looking at that kind of stuff, the sacks of rubbish that you carry around, and then opening it up and letting it go. It's worth it. So I have finished my talk for tonight. Thank you all for being present. And hopefully again see you soon. Oh, you got a question?
Sorry. Going back to like being like mindful, say when you're walking.
Yes.
And then you say to be aware of. So what are you actually being aware of? Is it your breathing? Is it your walking? Or is it your listening? So if it is everything, is it...
Okay. Really good point, actually. You're not being fixated. All right? You're just being... being mindful is like driving your car consciously, but being aware of all the side roads. So it's not that. So you're not going, okay, breathe in, breathe out. It'll be like trying to tell a centipede which foot to use first. It gets very complicated. No, you create a complete awareness of being present. The only analogy I can give you is when I teach Tai Chi, I teach each posture. And each posture has absolutely minute changes and things. But when you do the whole thing, you have this whole body awareness of the whole thing going on at the one time. So it's not fixating on any one thing. You're walking, you're just being aware of that. So it's not, we're not talking about walking meditation here. Just this idea, you just have to, I can't actually explain it. You have to experience it, but it's not being fixated on one thing. You're not going, take a step, do a breath. You'll end up not moving, going, uh-uh. It's not like that. It's just being this, it's kind of an, the only thing I can use the term on is awareness. All right? So it's again that analogy of driving a car but being aware of the side roads. You're not driving a car going, I'm not going to look at the side roads, because then you'll have a crash. So it's this, it's an overall awareness. So that's when you're going for a walk. If you're talking to someone, you're just being aware of their conversation. But you're also looking at their face, looking at their facial manner and the whole entity of that person talking to you. You're not really focusing on your own breathing. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Really, what you're going to have to do is actually do it. You'll find there'll be a place of just walking, being aware of the breeze. Sometimes you'll be aware of a breeze, or you'll see a rose. If you're walking in a park, you'll see a rose, and you'll think, "Oh, that's really beautiful." What you're not doing is, "Oh, Jesus, I've got to do that maths exam tomorrow." Or, do you see what I mean? You're taking yourself away from the experience of walking. You're going to go for a walk, and you're going to do that to be in nature. Whatever that, you might see a dog run past, and you're aware of the dog running past. That's a present time activity. But you're not thinking of other stuff when you're doing that. That's the point I'm making. Does that make sense? Yeah. Any other questions before we finish? No? Okay, thank you.